Good day, everybody. I got a special episode for you coming up right now. This is kind of a two-parter that we've thrown into one. It's like your Black Friday special or something. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody down in the great USA. I just want you to know you have until December 1st. Until December 1st to go and sign up for the ABS Intro to Blacksmithing that Maritime Knife Supply has a scholarship for. You can apply for this over on the New England School for Metalworks website and do yourself a favor. Go look into what you can do here. It's open for people ages 16 to 30. This is a great opportunity to get yourself really ahead in the knife game. And just one last thing before we jump into the show. Abana's holding their 50th anniversary celebration and conference June 6th to 9th, 2024 in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. You can find all the details over at abana.org/50th anniversary. You guys, blades, sculpture, traditional forging, the Abana National Curriculum. This is going to be a huge event. Don't miss out on it. Without further ado, on to the show.
Good day, eh?
Good day.
Good day, and welcome to another Forge Side Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between, with a heavy focus on talent in the Great White North.
That's Canada, eh? Today we have a special guest who's usually a co-host, Steve Cornelson, my good buddy from Ontario.
Ooh.
Hi, sometimes. Steve.
Bad Llama Forge.
Sometimes. There you go. Thank you for saying it right this time.
I said it right. I usually make up a different name every time I say his business.
People might not recognize this voice. They may recognize this voice. That's Rick Marchand coming at us from,
Lunenburg.
Yeah, Lunenburg,
Nova Scotia.
Thank you. I knew he was in Nova Scotia. So welcome to the show, guys. This is awesome. We've got Rick back as a we brought him in as a co-host because him and Steve actually have quite the long connection now. It goes quite far back. Steve's looked up to Rick for a long time. He studied under Rick back in the day. If you don't know who Steve is at Bad Llama Forge, go check out his Instagram because this guy's making some beautiful knives. And
oh yeah.
You know, who couldn't after studying with somebody like Rick Marchand who's making mind-blowing knives for how long now, Rick? How long's it been, bud?
I've been doing it for just over 18 years now. Seriously, like as a main source of income, I guess. Income is kind of a tricky word when you're a knife maker, though. I get a lot of outcome. I don't know how much income I get.
Oh, boy.
But no. Steve took my class and he's taking it in his direction, which I love. And he's doing things that I don't think I can do right now, but he's a good guy.
No, come on now.
Well, he is taking things in a pretty crazy direction because he actually went all the way out to Japan.
I know.
Right. Jealous. Partially to study knives, the Japanese culture and how that's all done. And Steve's here to tell us a little bit about his journey in that all. But before we get into that journey about how Steve went and traveled all the way to Japan for knives, what you been up to this week, dude? How's things going with you, man, Steve? Like, what's going on, dude? How you been?
Oh, geez. Well, I've been pretty good. As obviously you know, I've kind of been off and on the internets and whatnot, popping in on the show here and there. But
me and you stay in touch, dude.
Oh, we stay in touch. We stay in touch. But no, I've had a lot of positive changes in my life. I've got a lot more motivation and just like the urge to go to the shop. One big recent change, well, not so recent, but it's been finally finalized. So I'm just going to come out and say the shit that's been, I've been dealing with for so long, my divorce. I am officially divorced from China. Yeah, so, buddy. Like, it's
that's got to feel good. I know it was weighing heavily on your head, especially
there
when
was
you were here.
There was a weight on my shoulders there. Yeah, for sure. And actually getting it done and getting the papers, and now I keep those papers nice and safe here. It's nice because the court said we're only going to issue you these papers once. So
did you frame them? You gotta frame them. Just put them on the back of a picture somewhere so you know that they're there, but they're not on display. You know?
Oh, that's good.
It's like the Da Vinci Code on the back of a painting or something.
Jeez. I get it, that was
heavily on you when you took my course a couple years
yeah
ago,
that's right
a year whatever however long it was
that's right that was when it was kind of just starting to go into full swing.
Yeah,
and there was a lot of like, oh geez, like I need to find a lawyer in China to get this done because this is not easy.
I know every day you came into the shop and had something new that you were dealing with. Felt
oh
awful.
Yeah. Oh, it was fun, but you know, just you learn to like, I'm here to learn. So you put it in the back of your mind and you just kind of focus. It's not hard to focus on what's in front of us. Cause like, dude, I'm taking like an awesome knife class. So pretty easy to put the other things on standby.
Yeah.
How long ago was that now?
About 2
year and a half, almost 2 years.
Yeah.
No, it was in what month was that?
That it was April.
April.
I'm pretty sure it was April or May around there.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's been over a year and a half now.
It's gotta be because we heard about that.
I know you're making me do math in my head. Like, I can't.
Oh, you know what? If go back to the episode that we had with you back when, like your episode, Steve, right? I cannot remember what episode that was exactly, but
I've got an episode.
Pretty sure you had almost just taken that class not too long before we did that.
I actually think a closer point in which I finished Rick's class was when I started to actually co-host on the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
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 So it wasn't last April, but it was the April before. So however many months past
whatever that is.
You do the math.
There's too many. There's 12 months. There's too many months. I can't count that.
If you really want to know, you can do the math at home.
I need my vitamin B.
Don't care.
Honey, bring me my beer.
Oh, that's, see, now that, now we're talking about a tragedy now. Because I don't think I can have beer anymore.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
What's up?
It's an awful thing, man. Something with my gut. Maybe once I fix my gut flora or whatever, fauna, right. Whatever the heck it is. Maybe once I fix it, I can get back. I can have a beer, but I just pay for it pretty badly. And it got to the point where I was only having beer on special occasions. Mm-hmm. But then because it reacted with me so badly, they weren't special anymore. So I just don't have beer anymore, really. Unless I still love it. And everything that makes beer taste good, it's not the alcohol. I can't have non-alcoholic beer either. Everything that makes beer taste good makes me feel awful. So.
Uh-oh. Sorry to hear that, buddy.
Yeah, dang. I mean,
it is what it is.
It could be for the better. Not necessarily good for your health to be, well, wait a minute. Shouldn't be saying that. I'm trying to get sponsored by a beer company right now.
Trust me, I'd still be drinking beer. And I have nothing against beer. and I do try, like when the local breweries, when they have a new beer that they come out with and announce it, I do try it. It's just, you know, it's just like if you have something that you love, that, you know, if you love eating tacos, but they give you the shits, still eat tacos every once in a while. Just make sure that you're at home.
Running distance.
I mean, it's only expected if you're in Mexico, that's going to happen. And you go for it, right? You're in Mexico, you go for it.
Yeah. Or you just spot the closest hole in the ground.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
China life.
Nightlife. Dude, so I'd like to hear more about this Japan thing, man.
Yeah. That's, you met a new girl, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you guys decided you're going to go to Japan together.
That's right. Actually, we recently just celebrated our kind of just being together for a year. Actually, nice. We took a trip out to see Rick for that.
Oh, no way.
So, yeah, that was fun. We stayed in the same apartment that I stayed in when I was his student. So.
Oh, that's rad, dude.
Yeah.
It's good. Did you guys hang out in the shop at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually,
They were looking for couples counseling and stuff, so they came to me.
Pastor Rick.
So I put away my knife engineering book and brought out the Kama Sutra.
Oh God, it's gonna be one of those.
Wait, what kind of podcast is this? I keep forgetting. Anyway,
all over the place. Yeah.
Actually, on the last day that we were there, Rick was nice enough to bring my partner Mayu through a hook demo.
Cool.
So, like she made a hook,
like a wall hook.
Yeah, like a wall hook
thing. I have a little experience thing I do when we make a little wall hook in there, and she saw the drawing on my chalkboard of the steps to making a hook and everything. And I said, we could do it right now if you want. So we ended up doing it. It was fun.
Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah, that was a very memorable experience for her. She as soon as we got home, she wanted to put that hook on the wall and put the towel on. And funny enough, it's the same towel that I accidentally stole from your place.
It's my towel using the hook that we made here. Yeah. I stole a towel from my place, man. Just like...
We shop at the same store. My towel looks like his towel. I thought it was mine.
Well, I thought this was just like, you know, it's routine when you're staying at hotels. It's what happens.
Exactly. And you kind of
can't help it.
Put them in your suitcase. And...
Good thing he doesn't have any bathrobes to take.
Jeez. Okay, so the hook, what's the hook like? Can you explain it to me a little bit? Is it like you punched holes? What was the process?
Yeah, it was just a basic process. First, we taper it. We taper the end of the, I mean, we start with a rod, like a, I don't know what gauge that was, or I don't know, maybe 3/8, something like that, 3/8.
Round bar.
And then we just tapered it out like a square taper.
Oh, yeah.
So, and did a little scroll on the end, and then we twisted it. That's why we had the square, so that you could see the twist.
Nice, yeah.
And then, we just make it into a simple coat hook thing. Curl it, flip it, flatten the one end, and then we drill the holes in. We didn't punch the holes or anything like that, but we drill the holes in and beeswax it.
Nice.
It's fun. It's quick.
Yeah. That's awesome. Good stuff.
Steve did one alongside her, and it was good. I think hers turned out better than his, though.
So you guys decided to go to Japan together. What was the was the precedence behind you deciding to go to Japan? Like, I know you've got a love for Japanese culture, knives especially, right? The knife style and how they make knives, and that's always been out on your list.
It's I can't explain why. It's always been kind of a thing that's been front and center in my knife making.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not doing Japanese stuff exclusively. Like, I'll still do like Western style stuff, but I always find myself whenever I do a kitchen knife, I tend to gravitate towards that side of the fence.
Actually, it's kind of funny you said that, because you did that one knife that was like a crossover Western and Japanese style, right?
That's right. That's
right. That was a pretty cool knife, dude.
Thank you. I call that the Ibuki knife.
Right.
Kind of took some aspects of Western blade making that I really like, and some aspects of Japanese knives or Japanese blades that I really like, and I tried to kind of combine them too. Now the purists will hate that, but I don't know. I like what I do. I like how it came out. So,
well, what I like about what you're doing though is it's not just the Japanese aesthetic that you're doing. You're actually like when you were here, you wanted to build something not traditional and, you know, like completely traditional, but you wanted to build something the way that the Japanese actually assemble their blades, like that Tanto we did.
Right.
You wanted it very similar. So you're not just attracted to how they look. You're attracted to the way they're made too, which is
for sure.
Because I'm sure you're going to get into what you've done at your home forge since your visit and stuff like that too. But you're actually setting yourself up in a Japanese way at your forge as well. Like to have that choice between the Western stand up anvil and the sit down type of thing too, right?
Like, oh, yeah, got, I actually do have that at this point.
Oh
yeah,
no way!
I need to hear more about that.
Yeah, I know. You built a charcoal forge as well, right?
I built a Japanese style charcoal forge in my shop. Yeah.
Very cool.
Fucking rad, dude.
I moved a pile of garbage over and and did some digging there.
Can you use like actual coal with that too, like mineral coal, or is it just for charcoal for
lump? I mean, I assume that you could. I
the refractory would work.
I just don't know. And I mean the bed of charcoal fines is like it's pretty deep. It's the bed itself. If I can remember the measurements, I think it's 8 inches wide, 4 feet long, and
oh my gosh,
1.5 to 2 feet deep.
Wow, that's going to take a lot of coal.
it's filled to the brim with charcoal fines, and the reason you do that is just so you know you have a bed for your main fire to be on, and you can actually shape it to kind of whatever sort of I'm going to say fire pot, but it's more of a side blast forge than anything else.
Yeah, it's fire pot from the side, but I suspect that the layer of charcoal allows it to diffuse a little bit more than having that kind of blowtorch type thing going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about, okay, with charcoal though, or with coal, you're going to have your clinker. Where's your clinker going to go on a forge like that?
Well, I guess on a forge like that, it'll just go. So
collect and you have to clean it out when you're done?
Far down as it can go, yeah, and you'd have to collect it at some point. But
so does that forge have a? I forget what it's called. It's not a tier or a tour or whatever it's called. Does it have a spot that you can clean out the air vent there?
So it does actually have a tier right in the side. It's traditionally made from clay mixed with charcoal dust. But I just use some good old Unicast 70 because you can sculpt that into whatever you want. And geez, that stuff is strong as. So
where'd you get that from?
I got that from, I forget what they're called now, formerly a company called Smeltco in Ontario. Oh, but yeah. They're down, they're about, I guess, an hour away from me.
Doesn't one of our...
Does Lawrence carry that? Sponsors
carry that too? I think he does.
Lawrence carries a very similar one. He carries a Unicast product. I don't think it's Unicast 70, but it's like pretty darn similar.
Yeah, I've got them both.
Unicast 3000.
That's it.
Yeah, and that's a Maritime Knife Supply?
Maritime Knife Supply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can get like lots of other knife
lots of cool
supplies
stuff.
There. Yeah, like,
oh, you can get all kinds of stuff.
Belts, right? By 10.
You can empty your bank account there.
Yeah, exactly.
Black Friday's right around the corner. I've never done that before. You know?
It's scary. It's like it's one of those things where I think I'm doing a disservice to myself at the same time as doing a service because I don't go on his website a lot because he's always getting new stuff. And
There's a lot to look through.
And I could spend 2 hours on his website. And probably spend, you know, $1,000 if I got everything I wanted.
Well, that's it.
So I don't visit as often. I visit when I need to, And sometimes I'm just like, I'm going to go in and get what I need. I'm not going to look at anything else. You know, well,
that's exactly it though. Every time I go to his website, I say, okay, Steve, we're only going to spend $150 before shipping.
Yeah.
Oh, but we need that. Oh, but I need that. Oh, but he's got that. Ooh, that's right. Nice. It just escalates. And then it turns into like, oh shit, I just spent $500,000.
Did you get a even heat kiln from him? I can't remember.
No. I do have an even heat kiln, but I didn't get it from him. That was a Kijiji find.
Okay. Well, if he did want to get an even heat kiln, he carries those. He also carries Paragon kilns, and you can save $100 using the code FSE kiln. Didn't know if you knew that, but now you know. If you don't know, hey,
yeah, now you know.
Now you know, eh?
Okay, hey.
Yeah.
So Japan. Dude, Japan. Who did you have to convince her? Did she have to convince you? What's the story behind that?
It was just something, we were probably talking about it in like maybe month 4, month 5, just kind of chatting about, you know, it would be cool to go to Japan, and she likes to visit her family there, and I've always wanted to go there, and then it just kind of turned into a, hey, you know what? Let's do it this summer. And so we made plans, and she was just tremendous with making a plan. So
yeah,
we sat down and she
like
asked
a plan, me, like an itinerary type thing, or just
yeah. She's like, okay, what is your Japan bucket list? What are all the things you want to do in Japan? Like, just lay them all out, and we can try to figure out a path. So,
and then you instantly said, "I'd like to apprentice under a Japanese smith for 15 years." Did that fit into the itinerary?
I think we were a little bit short on time there. By maybe like 14 and like 7-8 years. So yeah, we only had about 2-ish weeks to stay in Japan, because, you know, we got jobs.
Where's her family located around there?
So her family lives on I believe the more rural side of Yokohama.
Okay.
So close enough to Tokyo that you can get there by train, by subway. But far enough away that, you know, you can just go out the front door, cross the street, and you're walking in wilderness, and there's like rice paddies and you know, fireflies at night. It's just
so the population density isn't as much around there.
Yeah, really cool. Really cool neighborhood too. Lots of hills and everything, like, like you're walking down that street,
dramatic,
you're looking
landscape
at it like, you rode a bike on this hill.
Yeah, I was worried when you came because of the hill in Lüneburg.
Oh yeah, no, that was
because Lüneburg's built on the side of the ocean, but it's just just a hill. And then Steve's like, she's from Japan, man. It's like, that's nothing. Is it a very dramatic landscape? Are there mountains in the background?
Well, you shared a picture on your Instagram of the knife village that you were at, dude. Like,
yeah, so I actually put quite a few pictures on there. There's
sweet.
They're just, from our trip, we experienced so many different types of landscapes, like from flats, you know, flatland, going past Mount Fuji, and then going through a tunnel in a mountain, and then all you can see is mountains and mist. Very, very like mystical looking. I got that video up there on my Instagram.
Puts the mist in mystical.
Yeah, puts the mist in mystical.
I just had some mist come out of a can of Fort Garry Rouge.
Nice.
Fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Describe the taste for me.
I don't know how to describe the taste of beers, really. I don't know. It's got a bit of a heavy flavor to it, but at the same time, it's light, smooth. A little bit of an afterbite.
So you just said it's light. No, it's not heavy, but no, you said it's heavy and light and it's smooth and
no, bites. No, it's heavy, but it's smooth with like this weird lightness to it, and then there's a very subtle afterbite.
Nice.
Does that make sense?
You're not making your case for that beer sponsor.
No, that doesn't make any sense. Okay. <no. laughs>
Well, I'll have to edit that out.
You gotta.
You should have just said it's a dichotomy.
I could have read the back of it and just told you that it's got a blend of specialty malts. I'm pretty sure, resulting in a pleasing crimson hue, medium bodied with a toffee finish and a subtle hop aroma.
Oh wow! Yeah,
there man. You
right
go.
Off the top of your head.
Yeah, when you do that for the beer company, just read it like Fraser Crane, and then. And then you've got it in the bag.
I'm no Fraser Crane person here, dude. I have no idea how that goes. Honestly, sorry, man. That's
you don't remember that show, eh?
No, I remember. I like avoided it. Okay. Like it was every time I saw it come on, I was like, not this garbage again.
See, I was a big Cheers fan, and Fraser was on Cheers. So when Fraser Crane came on, I didn't watch that as much as I did Cheers, but.
On Cheers, he was funny when he would come on Cheers. But if you watched the show he was on, it was just like, no, this is too much. I can't handle it.
At times, yeah. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I watched enough episodes that I could say that I watched Frasier.
Maybe it was the other main character that I was cringed of. Why am I using that word? Fuck.
Cringe?
Yeah.
Cringe, man. That's cringe.
I'm so woke.
You're on the fringe of cringe.
Right? Oh, dude.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I don't think I'm speaking loud enough. Am I not speaking loud enough?
You might not be. You could maybe bring yourself closer to the computer, but that's going to change everything if you change it halfway through the episode, dude.
Yeah.
I know. I see you're talking about the spikes at the bottom, right? On the...
Yeah.
Levels. Yeah, you're all way down there, hey?
Yeah, as long as it's coming through on the audio after. I'll try and get a little closer. You guys are going to be looking right up my nostrils.
Oh, it's like way louder now, dude.
Okay, good.
That's going to be fun to edit halfway through the episode. Oh, well. Not a problem.
It'll start off, you know, Rick was shy when he first started talking, and then he got into his element and raised his voice.
He saw me drinking a beer and got all excited.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Japan.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what do you want to know?
Okay. Well,
I want to know how you found your little village and how you approached the knife maker.
Okay. So we went to a couple villages, but the village in my video. That is, it's called Shirakawa-go, and it's a World Heritage Site. So it's a very, very traditional village, and you can go there during the day. There's buses that come and buses that go, but staying overnight, you need, let's just say it's not easy. And somehow, Mayuko, she found a way to get us lodgings overnight, which is like no small feat. And that was like, you could just feel the stress melting off it. They really, really just give you a nice experience there. But after that village, we went to Kefu. Some people might know of Takefu Knife Village. It's basically a co-op workshop. They have a whole bunch of different teams. I guess I want to use the word team. I'm gonna use the word team. Let's see, 13 associated knife makers operating out of two large workshops.
That's pretty good.
you take a taxi there. It's this standalone little complex, and you walk in. There's a museum about. There's two museums. There's one museum totally dedicated to the tools of the craft and how the knives are made. They have like a series of progressions of knives there, and then they have this other museum, which is like kind of abstract knife art. And
that's where you sent me the picture of the dragon made completely of knives, right?
Oh, yes, that was actually at the subway, at the train station in Tekefu. You get off, and there was encased in glass a dragon sculpture entirely made of knives. And according to
the plaque, thanks for sending me that pic, Steve.
I sent you others.
Yeah, the ones that I told them not to send me.
So there's, I can send you that picture. according to the folks there, the plaque on the, I think it was the plaque, or we heard it from, can't remember. Not going to waste time diving into that. But all the knife makers in
just
the
make
city,
it up.
Yeah, I'm going to make it up. All the knife makers in the city contributed to making the pieces for that sculpture there.
So basically they gave their shitty blades?
Basically, yeah.
I got a lot of blades that they could have used.
Well, you're out there making wind chimes with yours.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. All the blades that I did.
A really good idea.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome idea.
So yeah. So when I do little classes and experiences, I forge out a blade real quick for people. But because I talk at the same time, I don't use actual knife steel. I use like hardware store bar, you know, like just bar of steel. So I have all these little knives that I've forged out that aren't hardenable or anything like that. And like I'm talking, at times I have 50, 60 knives here that wow. are knife-shaped objects. So I make little wind chimes out of them. But
nice.
Now I'm thinking, man, maybe we should all of us get together and make a dragon of knives.
Could make something other than a dragon. Could be anything. Like, dude, we could make some, like, you could make some like wicked stuff.
Like a chihuahua.
A chihuahua would be
a knife totally chihuahua.
A knife chihuahua. Yeah.
I don't think it'd be worth doing, dude. I'm sorry. I mean, yeah. Just the teeth. I mean, knives. They pretty much are.
What about something like better, like a pug?
No, sorry.
No,
I know. Okay. It's got to be like.
I think I'm way off base here.
Yeah, I was thinking something more majestic, like a unicorn.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
For fuck's sakes.
It goes silent.
Japan, back to Japan. Fuck. Yeah.
So nobody was silent when I said pug or freaking chihuahua, but man, you mentioned a unicorn. It's like, whoa, that's too far, dude.
Yeah, too far. Read the room, dude.
I did.
Start a new list. Things Lando needs to work on.
Let's do a mythical creature, like a rich knife maker.
Oh, yeah. That's really good.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah.
All right, so
the elusive smart welder.
So now you're at this other is it a city or a village?
So it's Tekefu's a city, but they call it Tekefu Knife Village just because it's sort of outside of the city, so it's its own little mini village, but it's not really a village. It's just a big communal workshop.
Right.
And it was really cool with, you know, you go through the first museum all about knife making, and you go out onto this balcony that just overlooks the entire shop. And you see the folks on those really huge round whetstones going real fast. You see folks on the power hammers and just everyone's doing something. Then you see in the corner, these guys are just on literal 4x36 grinders with shop vacs attached to it. And they're doing handles, you know,
like, that's awesome.
If anything, it's a testament to show, like, you don't need the biggest and best tool to get the job done. Like,
no,
got the time, use what you got. Right. But no, yeah. They were totally using 4x36 grinder to do their handle material.
Yeah. Makes sense. Were they doing like a lot of wah handles, like traditional stuff, or was it all over the
place? There was a lot of wah handles. I'd say I didn't see a handle that wasn't a wah handle at that place.
Wah handle is that traditional octagonal type of handle that you see on Japanese knives. Thanks, it's man. Done. It doesn't. And it's very it's deceptive how they're made. It looks like it's just a hole drilled and you put the handle on. But the way they're made traditionally is a completely different thing. And it's it consists of like four or five parts, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a dowel that goes down the middle because they like to use a lot of traditionally they would use a hoe wood, which is a magnolia, which is really, really close to poplar. Yeah.
So it's it can compress, right? Can't it or something like that? Isn't it?
It's a very softer. Lightweight. It's a very it's pretty soft, lightweight, but a lot of the higher end handles are using a lot of like hardwoods, exotics, stuff like that. But to make things easier, they put a dowel through the middle of it, so they have a nice, easy place to bed the tang and everything.
Yeah, it's like they drill like a big hole down it,
mm-hmm.
and then they take a dowel and they actually split the dowel. Do you not like you?
Yep.
Cut it.
There's a thin slit in the dowel, okay.
And then
so when
then
you do
insert
a little bit of a burn,
then you insert the dowel down the hole, and then you put a cap on the end of the thing with a little hole that kind of fits the.
Yeah,
knife, but the whole thing is made as a compression fit. Like, there's no pin that goes through it. It's meant to be taken off, like, so that if you redo the blade, if you want to regrind the bevel, or if you just want to clean it, you can pop the wah handle off, clean it, and then throw it back on. It's press fit, right?
Yeah. Nowadays, what they're doing is at Takefu, at least, is they are using epoxies, but that is the traditional. Traditional yeah. way. You can see all sorts of YouTube videos of, you know, how to take your wah handle off, how to, you know, clean everything, put it back together, and
it's very cool.
Oh, it's a very interesting and simplistic yet intricate system.
Cool.
Yeah, cool. Good fun.
So you're at Takefu for how many days? Or are you just there for
We just pulled through for one day. We stopped to have a look, and we met some of the makers there, which was really nice. Actually, I think I have I have one of the pictures with one of the senior makers up there, Hideo Kitaoka, and he was really nice enough to, you know, take some time away from his day and just kind of chill with us. And answer a whole bunch of questions that I, you know, kind of gave up scouring the internet for. And,
yeah.
You know.
It's true, though. There's only a certain amount of questions you can get from the internet and from videos and stuff. Actually
sometimes
going,
the source is the best.
Actually going to visit somebody that's doing it. You learn the subtleties, you know, like it's different, especially when you can watch them do it. So it's new Takefu for just a, you just pass through type thing.
We just passed through. We were actually, that was the first stop. We were on our way to Tokyo. Sorry. No, we were on our way to Kyoto. we came from Tokyo direction, Shirakawa go to Kafu, and then our next stop was Kyoto.
How are you traveling this whole time? Like you said, you took a cab.
Bullet train.
Bullet train, no.
So, and I'm just like, you know, riding in, like, we were just riding in economy, but man, Via, take notes. Like, get your shit together. Via Rail.
Jeez, yeah.
No, it was really nice. Shots and fired. Totally. Don't even get me started on the TTC. Bunch of cretins. I swear to God, like, can you be on time?
No,
once?
I'm sorry.
Can you be on time once?
I triggered Steve. Oh no.
Oh.
Here you go. Okay.
Yeah. So we.
There goes the conversation. Thanks, Lando.
Oh, for sure. But no, it's actually so if you ever do visit Japan, you can buy a pass for the bullet train. It's kind of all you can ride for 7 days, 14 days. You can buy different durations, but
different calibers. Travel,
bet you that
different calibers of bullet train.
Yeah.
Ride the bullet Both train.
Going to make a joke at the same time.
Fuck sakes.
Yeah. So,
sorry.
No, we bought the tickets. It's not. Those sales are not open to locals. So you have to have a tourist entry in your passport to get that ticket.
Oh,
but once you have it, it's like you'd be smart to get it. You save more than half of what it would cost to buy tickets normally.
Wow.
Well, if you're going to be traveling around a bunch in the country and stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. If you're just going to take the train once, one round trip is probably not worth it. But if you're doing a lot of city hopping, you're going to want to get it.
Yeah. Okay. And how did you know where to go in all these different places in Japan? Was it because of your
Mayuko?
Yeah. You missed that part.
It's Mayuko.
Coughing spasm. So before we left, Mayuko just helped put together a list of all the stuff that I would be potentially interested in. And she just created this amazing itinerary of the most efficient way to do things, where to go, where to stop, where to stay, who to see. She found all these knife makers that she thought we could go visit, drop in on. And that was like really cool. She
lucky
really
man.
Outdid herself on that. Oh, holy, okay. I know. Very lucky.
That's right.
But Kyoto was a fun place. We dropped in on a bunch of different knife stores, chatted with the owners. It was really cool just to see kind of what sort of selections they have available. And a lot of these knife stores, all the knives come from, you know, local makers, which was really cool to see. Just, you know,
yep.
Local folks getting support from retail, right?
Unlike most Canadian knife stores you go into.
Oh, hell, dude. Yeah. I wouldn't want my knives in a Canadian Tire anyhow.
So it's a Canadian Tire.
it's very different there, isn't it, Steve? It's especially, well, not especially for knife makers, but as a knife maker, it's held in a higher regard, right?
Yeah.
The craft itself?
I definitely believe so. And so here's an interesting thing. When I was going over there, I don't know why I had that idea in my head, but I was fully prepared to be stonewalled when I started asking questions or kind of maybe going too far, branching into territory that maybe they might want to safeguard.
Right.
Boy, was I wrong. When Mayu told them that I was also a knife maker, and they, like most of them, their eyes just lit up, and we just, you know, went down that rabbit hole.
That's
and
great.
They answered everything. like in great detail. Anything I asked, they had an answer for. And well, what it really is not just the sword maker community, but the knife maker community is declining. Like, they're trying to bring interest and bring people to, you know, carry it on, but yeah, it's just not increasing. So
they need to run an episode of
They are happy to pass on that information to people who will use it. Right?
Yeah, they would do well making their own Japanese version of Force and Fire. Then everybody will be interested.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Everybody will be a knife maker within a month. But it's going to go all to, like, Trash Can Damascus and...
Oh. don't.
I don't know.
Forge. Yeah, I got a set of golf clubs. What kind of knife can I make with it?
Do they have Forged in Fire in different countries? Like, UK edition Forged in Fire? Like, I know they have that for, like, different TV series.
There was supposed to be a Canadian one when it first came out. I tried to apply for Forged in Fire, and I couldn't do it because they cut it off to U.S. residents only.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I got contacted by a Canadian, I don't know if they were a counterpart at the time, but it was supposed to be a show called Masters of the North, and it's a Canadian version of Forged in Fire. And that was after the first season of actual Forged in Fire. They were going to release this Canadian version, and my mentor, Wally Hayes, and Sean Cunningham, as well, from Front Step Forge. They both went to Toronto and auditioned, or whatever you call it, to be on the panel, the judges.
No way.
That, so they went there, and it was, I did a couple Skype interviews and everything, and they said, okay, you know, hold tight, and but nothing came of it. The I guess the network didn't pick it up.
Oh, it was rumored that
they didn't want it to take away from the American one at all. So they said maybe we'll have it later, but it just never happened.
Dang. That's too bad. That would have been so rad,
I
man.
Don't think that they have it like Forged in Fire Japan or Forged in Fire Iceland.
I wouldn't know too much about Japanese TV to give you a solid answer one way or another.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I guess my knowledge of Japanese TV, I mean, I like some shows, but if you ask me my favorite, it's MXC.
Oh, yeah.
That shit was fun.
Most Extreme Challenge.
I don't think you could call it Japanese in the end.
No.
It's Domino. But I tell you what, those writers, those guys are geniuses.
Kenny Blankenship.
Yep.
So, Mayuko took a lesson in Japan, did she not?
Correct. Course. This was when we were in Kyoto. We took a taxi probably about an hour north or so, like 45 minutes to an hour around there. I can't really remember. I was staring out the window the whole time. It was awesome. But yeah, we went to this place, this workshop in the middle of nowhere, and it was run by like a licensed katana maker. And she found this guy's workshop through Tourism Kyoto, and she booked a workshop. And originally it was going to be me, but I'm like, no, you should do this. Like, this, you should do this. I want to look around his shop. Like, I'm going to snoop. Right. You got to do like this. This is an experience that you should have. Like, go for
it. That's awesome.
Right? Because she's always been interested in, you know, what I do. And she knows the names of the people that I, communicate with. Like, she knows you, Lando. She knows you, Rick. But she's never really, up until that point, she's never really done anything with hammer in hand. So we figured, hey, that.
Well, nope, shit, zip it,
Lando.
Yep,
yep.
Shake my head at you.
I know
she does now.
I am not disappointed.
I'm not playing off that, but she does have good hammer technique. I can tell you that.
Right?
Yeah. That was supposed to be clean.
It was.
she literally has
compliment.
That would be terrible if it wasn't.
Good hammer technique. It would be awful. Yeah. She did.
She
picked up on it really quickly. What's that?
You're better than that. We all know you're better than that. That's a road I might add a few more beers. I might venture down that road.
Yeah.
Well, let's get through this before Lando gets there. We all know he'll go there.
Yeah. When the pants come off.
What are you talking about? Were they ever on?
Well, we only see you from like.
I don't know, you're making assumptions, right?
Mid torso up. So I'm hoping that you've got, you know, you're fully clothed, but hey.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, no. So we got there and he brought us into so we thought we were gonna hit the workshop right out of the gate. But no, he spent a good like it must have been 2 hours, maybe 2.5. Maybe 1.5. I don't know. I'm not going to go down that road. But we spent a long time going through the theory and just talking about all things katana. Just even just stuff as small as like the tamahagane and the pattern in the tamahagane and how they can coax the pattern out. Very similar to coaxing a pattern out of Damascus, right? But he was saying that, you know, that stuff combined with the type of hamon, you would have a really good idea of where that sword came from or where the maker came from. Because right. Different tamahagane patterns and different hamons were more common in certain areas than others.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, no, so, it is cool how you can tell those type of things, right?
Yeah.
There's a gentleman here in Nova Scotia that he's known as an authority on forging, and he can look at a forged piece that does not have any kind of stamp on it whatsoever and tell you who made it out of the local blacksmiths and that, because he can, cool. He knows the hammer marks, he knows the style. Everybody does something a little bit differently than somebody else. And this guy knows it's so well that he can tell you out of and this is like vintage stuff, like these are like over the last 100 years, he could tell you what part of Nova Scotia that was built and or made and who did it.
It's very crazy. Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
That's right. Yeah.
Very
yeah.
cool.
Mind blown, actually.
Yeah. So we went through that whole class, just, you know, really interesting stuff. I found it interesting. I feel like a couple other folks there were getting a little restless. And there was this, so usually he books classes for Japanese people and then he books separate classes for the tourists because, you know, less of that, right? But there was an American guy there, and his ticket was booked by his aunt, who's local. So he was just sitting there, just kind of everything just going over his head because it was all in Japanese, right?
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. Oh, all the lesson was in Japanese, right? Like, so
Steve,
Mayuko.
Steve, how good is your Japanese? Can you hear somebody speak it and know what they're talking about?
Sometimes. I would not say I can conduct a conversation well. I can pick out things in sentences and kind of figure out keywords sometimes, but it could be a lot better. Let's just say that currently my Chinese is much better than my Japanese and I'm looking to remedy that. But
so how so, did you, your well, partner
Ayuko
translated
was translating, a lot of it. Not all of it, just, you know, the parts that were kind of imperative to follow the conversation. And then for stuff like technical terms that it might not have kind of crossed over, that's when I would kind of pick up the gist and then translate that properly to kind of like, oh, okay, so the layers in the Tamahagane, that's actually this happening, and that's why that happens. So I just kind of down the chain, and you know, we help the kid out and understand that. Then after that whole session, we went into the workshop, and he had two Japanese style charcoal forges there, and they were going at it. And they had the wooden box bellows and everything. Antique wow. box bellows from the Edo period. So
wow.
those are really cool. Oh, still fully functional, still using them. He offered to sell me one at a really cheap price, but if I knew the shipping would bankrupt me, I would have taken him up on that.
Just to have it, right?
Just yeah. to have it, yeah. I don't even need to use it. Well, I would put it up display in my house. No although kidding. Mayuko would probably not be cool with that. But yeah, but you know, it was really cool. It was really cool to use it. And again, information. There was no wall. I asked him so many questions about the forge construction and then everything, and he was like, obviously I waited until there was a break, you know. But
yeah,
he was more than willing to do that. He was more than willing to share his recipe for his hamon clay, and which I was like, oh my god, really? Awesome! Yeah. Like, very grateful for that. Yeah, and they all on their first knives, they did the heat treat by themselves. They put a hamon on there. And it all in a water quench.
That's great.
Yeah.
So were they using, I take it they weren't using Tamahagane, right?
No, that was an option. You could pay more and use Tamahagane.
No way.
But for the, for this demonstration, I guess the steel that we were using is more comparable to 1080.
Okay, so it's just a mono steel? You didn't yeah. do Senmai or anything like that?
No, just a mono steel.
Cool.
And that's, you know, that's for your first knife, that's really all you need.
Yep.
No need to get fancy.
What's a recipe for a hamon clay look like? Like, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of guys are just using something like Satanite for doing yep. hamons, right?
Yeah. And in other cases, some people are adding other stuff to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not gonna indulge what other stuff is.
I would have to ask him if I can share that like on this platform before out of respect.
So I can share it because Steve didn't really. Well, oh, I mean, okay. Told,
well, there we go.
No, well, Steve told me, so I'm allowed to tell you.
No, fuck me, right?
No, he told me, but I'm not going to use the thing he told me. But I did look it up and look into all that stuff as well. And it can be anything with a combination of you can actually have like steel filings in it. You can have charcoal in it. They mix mm-hmm. it in. There's all kinds of things that you can put in it that help it do what it's supposed to do.
Interesting.
I guess. Yeah. Right? But yeah, it could be iron filings, so all that stuff. Like actual rust, like they scrape rust and put it in there.
You right. also mentioned scale. Folks use scale as well.
Yes, scale. Yeah, yeah. They take yeah. scale.
Finally a use for that shit.
So you know all the scale you get that you're always cleaning up? Put that stuff in a jar. Because it's got so many uses. I had a blacksmith Chris, what's his last name? I forget his name. We called him Swiss Chris. He's from Switzerland. He stayed here for about 3 weeks, and he did a big hammering and forged out this little hand bottle opener. But the cool part that everybody was interested in is how he treated it after so it wouldn't rust. And he took the he took the scale and ground it up into like this fine dust and then mixed it with raw linseed oil and then made a paint out of it.
Oh, and dude. He painted on.
And once it cured, it was like he said that this is what they traditionally use to keep stuff that was outside from rusting.
That is so awesome.
And
okay.
I remember.
Yeah, you remember?
Well, I remember John Little was there, and everybody knows John Little, or they should know John Little.
Yeah.
John and Nancy, and John was just like, man, I think of all the scale I've thrown out. He's like, now I know what I'm going to do with all this stuff. He's going to have buckets of it, right?
Well, it's not hard to collect a bucket of scale, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But if you need
so people also use that in there. Oh, that's true. We have a linseed oil.
Yeah, well, the Twiller linseed oil likes to look after us a little bit, and we like to look after them. They're the makers of the Twiller linseed oil out of Saskatchewan. These are two brothers that are making some amazing linseed oil that is food grade, safe, good stuff. I can't say enough good stuff about their products. Every time I talk about them, it's like, yep, it's the stuff. They've got their paste wax. They've got a couple different styles of that you can pick up. They've got different finishes for wood as well that you can look at getting. These guys are doing everything right that you can do right when it comes to business. I highly suggest you go check them out at thetwillylinseed.com. Use the code FORGECHAT10 on orders $50 or more, and you'll save yourself 10%.
That's awesome.
Fantastic. That's your second half of the mix. You've got the scale. They've got the linseed oil.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at that.
That's good. Yeah. So get back on your stuff, Steve. Sorry for interrupting.
Actually I have on my Instagram, I keep saying that, but that's where all the videos are. On my Instagram there is a video of Mayu doing her heat treat under the instructor's instruction.
No way. I did see that.
She's operating the box bellows. We turned off the light so you can see the actual color of the steel. And just with every pump, the embers from the charcoal just go right up towards the duct. And it was just really something special about that ambiance, man.
Like, yeah,
that's awesome. As soon as I saw that happening, I'm just like, I need to build myself one of these in my shop. Like, everything else goes on hold. This is happening.
That's awesome.
And it was really nice. Everyone's knife turned out good. Everyone got a very active hamon.
How did you bring the hamon out? Because they don't do it with acid, right?
No. They don't do it with acid. And at that point there, all he did was do a rough grind on each knife for them. Because like, traditionally, you're going to be using stones and everything, right, to bring out that hamon. But he did a rough grind. But even at what it's like 60 or 80 grit, like it was very definitive. You could see it poking through. So, like as far as I know, if you see that at that low grit, you're going to get something nice once you polish it up.
Yeah. And so, I don't know the mechanism, but I do know that I can see a hamon if I use my stones or a diamond plate or something like that to grind the bevels. I can see the hamon pop out, but not so much with my belts.
Mm.
And I don't know what the mechanism is. I've heard people say, well, belts tend to smear the steel to a certain extent because it's dragging through, whereas like a water and stones, it kind of pulls the metal away evenly, and you can see the difference, you know, the transition zone of the hamon.
Right.
I've heard it explained that way. It kind of makes sense because, I mean, one of them, I mean, unless you're running a variable speed and you're running it really low and you use water, you are smearing the steel with your belt when it's dragging, because it's dragging pieces of metal off, right? So
yeah, that would all clean off with your, like in your final rinse and whatnot, wouldn't it?
But it's that friction. It's not just plucking the steel out. It's dragging it, and then eventually it breaks off and comes out. Where I believe by hand you're using less pressure, and I don't know, man.
That don't make any sense to me. It makes
enough sense to me that I'm not going to disregard it, but it hasn't made enough sense that I'm actually going to look it up.
Can't argue with that.
This is coming from somebody that doesn't know shit about Hormones or knives, so don't take my word for nothing.
I don't know a lot about Hormones. I know how to do them. Steve and I did them when he was there. Yeah. I know enough. Like, I know how to make them, but I don't know the intricacies. I kind of know what's going on with the metallurgy part of it, like with what's actually what you're seeing with the Hormone. Yeah. But I don't know enough to know what outside forces can manipulate Hormone. I know that when I worked with Wally, he didn't want to put any kind of like Scotch-Brite wheel or any kind of thing on it, because he said it would diminish the Hormone. I keep saying
shout
Mahone
out to
because,
Mahone Bay.
Yeah, because the neighboring town is Mahone Bay here, so it's in my head. Anyway, so continue.
Yeah. That was quenched. You know, we it was quenched. He did the grind, you know, and everyone got a little box with their own little knife in it. And it was just a really nice thing. And everyone, you know, it's like five of us walked in there complete strangers, well, except for my you and me. But we all just by the end, we're basically on first name basis with each other. It was just a really fun event, and I don't know, man, I was really happy there. That was just, I learned so much, and I was in another fella's workshop learning about, like, I mean, essentially we're trying to complete the same goal, but the tools are so different, so it's really interesting to learn about the differences and everything. So that was
I have to ask another question that's
yep.
very important to me. What was he wearing?
Oh.
Shut up. Shut up, Lando.
It's take off, eh, Ozer?
He was wearing what you would expect, the traditional workshop clothes in Japan.
Yes.
So
yeah. What so traditional. So he had the kimono top and that kind of thing, or
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's what I want to wear.
And he was wearing a hakama too.
But I'll
which
be
is like the pants
culturally appropriating.
Pants, but not pants.
Yeah.
A skirt.
Yeah, hakama.
Very breathable. Very breathable stuff.
Yeah, they're kind of like, it's like an
oversized.
Skirt. It's an oversized skirt.
With,
I used to wear one.
With the crotch way down by your knees.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like MC
very
Hammers. MC yeah. Hammer skorts.
Can't touch this.
Yeah.
Very comfy.
Yeah, that's that's what I wanted to know, because I always wanted to wear that because it is very comfortable. I mean, like I had a lifetime of martial arts, so I wore the hakama and all that stuff when I took
Have you ever hung out with Sean Cunningham, dude?
Yeah.
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 You
yeah,
too.
Yeah. He came.
Go?
What's that?
I could see you two wearing that kind of gear. Well, he has that gear. He's into that, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Oh yeah, man. We talked about a lot of that stuff.
And, I guess the next time I come out your way, I'm gonna have to bring I'll have to bring my set, and we can get all dressed up.
I think I still have my hakama, but
just gonna have to.
But I can't wear it now,
summer,
because I'll be a fat white guy culturally appropriating.
Take off, you hoser.
I know. But
I got a brilliant idea out of this, dude. Rick, me, you, and Sean. What do you say? We need to get him back on the Forge Side chat, and the three of us sit down for another conversation. I think that would be right awesome and talk.
That would be fun. I really like
I'm not a
Sean.
Or
really
anything.
Well, I mean, yeah. I've been told that once you get that many people on the podcast, it gets to be too much. So
no, it's
yeah.
I'll let you off this time, Lando.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Kind of a jerk. Make plans while somebody you're not inviting is present.
Yeah. If we want to have a really good podcast, we shouldn't have Steve on it. We should have...
You're a freaking guest, you hoser. Jeez. Like, you can't be on every episode. Jeez, Louise. And you know what, man? Honestly, we need to get you back on more often as a co-host. I miss you, dude.
Why not? I'm down for that. I'm down for that.
Yeah. Alrighty. Yeah. Awesome. But anyways, my bad. Sidetracked us all.
We digress.
Yeah. He was wearing the traditional garb. Yeah. Looking good. Wearing nothing underneath, probably, as one should, right? I don't know.
I don't know about that.
Okay, never mind. I don't know
what kind of books
going.
Are you reading?
Books. What are books?
Well, there we go. Okay. Mystery solved.
He gets all his Japanese information from Pornhub.
Fuck that. Answers a lot of questions, actually. Yeah.
Don't deny it, Lando. Don't deny it.
Don't go there, all right?
That's not a no.
Excellent. All right.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so we finished up the class, all said our goodbyes, we went back to Kyoto, and I wanted a little something from Kyoto, just a little souvenir, because Kyoto
Some
was a
nookie.
Big... That was a big, just a lot happened. A lot of knife shops, a lot of, you know, makers slash shops, and that workshop needed something to just kind of remember the place by. So, unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to visit there's one to the north and one to the south, but it's a quarry where they mine sharpening stones. Whetstones, rather.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And so but thankfully we found a shop that sells them based off of their quality, weight, size. And I found one that was, it checked all three boxes for me. And I'm just
That's
like,
awesome.
Yep, this is a nice, good piece. I will be able to use it. Not sure I want to, but it's a piece, a literal piece of Japan that I can bring home with me.
So
that's related to knife making.
Buddy.
So now you kind of have a thing, because when you were here, you took home a stone.
That's right.
That you wanted to make
a
knife stone.
600 grit would be its equivalent.
Yeah,
something
around there,
right? Around
there. We have formations around here. It's basically slate rock, but they break off. Sometimes in like perfect squares.
Okay.
And I've made sharpening stones out of them before.
No way.
I don't know how consistent the grit is, but they work. Like, I make these little stones. Well, I got one hanging up over here, but I make these little pendants, and one side of them I flatten. And so you can wear it, and then you can take it and rub it on your knife and sharpen it.
But, dude. Steve
took a piece that was probably 3 inches by 6 or 8 inches.
You sell those
on your questions for me on the check-in.
That should be an item, dude. That's a
probably should. They're kind of cool.
Yeah, and Maritime should carry them. Dude, you got a hot ticket item right there, brother. Like, for real. That's
kind of like
money.
They're kind of like Viking. So that's the sharpening side. I'm showing a picture right now.
I want one. I fucking want one. I'm not even a knife maker. I fucking want one, dude.
And Steve, can you read that?
It's pretty blurry.
No.
Oh. That's kind of blurry.
Sorry, bud. I can't make it out.
I think it says something stupid.
That's typical person getting a Japanese tattoo.
I just wanted to see if
Oh my god, I love those.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I just want to see if I could carve on it. So I carved. I think it just says knife or or something.
Well, that's rad, kinda, dude. Yeah. You think it does?
Anyway, I don't know.
Where okay? So where are you at in your trip here? You're back in Kyoto.
We're in Kyoto. We're getting ready to leave. We did knife stores. I got my rock, my whetstone. We did the workshop, and now we're heading in the direction of Osaka, which is arguably not very far at all from Kyoto. They're very close. So we're going down there, but as we go there, we're deciding, okay, now Osaka is very close to a very famous place for knives. And this place is the city of Sakai. So if you go into any Japanese knife store that, you know, that's worth their salt, that knows what they're doing, mm-hmm. and you drop the name Sakai, mm-hmm. they'll know, because Sakai is, there's a lot of knife makers there. There's a lot of quality product coming from there.
It's like saying Sheffield, right? It's like the Sheffield of Japan. Mm. Sheffield, England is the where all the knives come from, man.
Oh, yeah. Right. There's so many knives that come from Sakai. Like, you can't walk through a back street or just down a road without spotting a knife shop or a knife workshop. So it was just really cool just to go down there. We went to the Sakai Knife Museum, which is called Cut. And it's really cool because they have volunteer makers from some of the more prolific shops in the city. And the master or one of the workers will volunteer in the museum and just kind of tell people all about what's going on.
Very cool.
While we were there, we came across a it's very cool because, you know, while we're there, we're just kind of trying to entertain the idea. Well, how would a non-Japanese person go about starting up making a shop in Japan? Like, just you know, out of curiosity, trying to figure that out. But we ran into a French gentleman who owns his own knife shop in Japan.
Crazy.
This is Sakai Knives. And very, very nice guy.
What's the name of his shop?
This is Sakai Knives. Like, oh, okay. As in French. Duh,
right? I thought he was going to, like, have a French name, like Little Wee Wee or something.
No, I think as far as French goes, it's the...
Hey, did I ever tell you about my fascination with frogs?
Here we go.
Oh, God.
I think it stems back to my first romantic relationship. It was in Quebec.
What the hell are you... Where are you going?
I don't know.
Your first romantic relationship with a frog?
Come on, man. Quebec, am I having... frogs,
you've got
French
issues,
people...
Dude.
Well, I know. I knew that right away. I thought it was just going to be more intellectual.
It's not supposed to be.
Okay.
Take it too
Have
far.
Have you listened to the show?
Yeah. Dumb it down a little bit, Rick. Jeez. Wow. Yeah. I thought we rolled together before. You know how this goes.
I don't know, man. That was low hanging fruit, man.
Yeah, I know. I getcha. Gonna say
it's like just a step above fart jokes. It's like just a little bit more than a fart. It's like a shark joke.
He said fart.
I did, didn't I? Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay,
so he kind of brought us through his whole, basically his life story on how he became set up and established in Japan. He's second generation blacksmith. When he came to Japan, he found a master to study under, but he said one of the biggest difficulties was a lot of the bladesmiths who who will teach, who they want to teach you fresh. They don't want to spend their time working out any kinks or old habits.
They want an empty cup.
Yeah. So it's, you know, kind of like that. But it was very interesting just hearing his story. I'm not sure how much time we have. Couldn't really go into too much, but during his apprenticeship, he would basically just be teaching English or French in Osaka. Just take the subway up there. As we were leaving Sakai, we stopped at so many knife shops. We decided to stop in a one back alley shop, and we met another fellow. Just this shop was basically a hole in the wall. Didn't even look like a shop, but I saw an outline of a knife screwed to the side of the building, and I'm like, oh, we have to try.
No way. Like,
what if it is? And sure enough, it is. It's a knife workshop, and there's a bunch of, there's like three guys in there just working away, and then there's this one guy in a sandblast cabinet. Right.
The whole guy?
No. Well, he's at a sandblast cabinet.
Okay.
Just
Lando. Lando was just thinking the same thing. I'm like,
I should have been more specific.
Well, okay, so I've ran a massive sandblaster when I was younger, when I worked for a trailer company, and yeah, you're holding the big hose and you got to wear the big suit and the helmet, and that's what I was picturing right away. I was those guys standing in a big hose spraying sand.
He said it was a hole in the wall, so I was very intrigued about it.
Yeah.
I'd say the cabinet's like, I don't know, the size.
Like a sandblast cabinet.
Maybe like 30 inches long. It's a sandblast cabinet, dude. What do you want from me?
Sandblast cabinet. Take measurements. It's about the size of those things at Princess Auto. You know those cabinets?
Yeah, those things with the chains. And then sandblast the things in. Dongling on the top.
God.
I made a sandblast cabinet out of a Rubbermaid bin and a piece of plexiglass. And I cut two holes.
No.
And then I fed everything through with gloves.
Yeah. How long did that last?
It worked for about two knives, and then the whole plexiglass was all it got frosted.
Yeah.
All the stuff. And then all the dust was blowing out between my glove and the holes. It was awful.
Well, the interesting use of the of sandblasting here was at this place, and this is one of the things I wanted to touch on, I learned a lot about the Japanese version of Damascus. Mm. So one of the things that I find here versus there, like I'd say 9 times out of 10, when they do Damascus, they'll have a core steel in it still. They won't bring the Damascus layers right to the edge.
Yeah.
Right. They'll put a core in there.
I believe that for an actual functional reason, but continue.
So I noticed, you know, like over here, a lot of like almost every single Damascus reveal video you see, it's always something to do with acid, right? Like it's pulling it out of the acid, which hey, I ain't gonna slag that.
That's why I asked you.
Works for me.
Right? That's why I asked you earlier about the acid, that they don't use acid, right?
Yeah, no, they don't. And, you know, as I'm over there, there's a lot of Damascus knives there too. Granted, it has the core, but there's one thing that stands out about the Damascus there than the Damascus here. And that's, well, our patterns are a lot bolder here. They stand out a lot more. They really grab your eye. Over there, it's very subtle, like subtle stuff. You can see it very easily, but it's not so like in your face.
Well, they're not etching it, so it's not turning black. It's not getting the oxide.
That's right.
Yeah.
And So I was asking him about that because he's got the knife in there in the sandblast case, and his guy is just brushing it with the sandblaster, right? And as he's doing that, the pattern is emerging.
I know why.
Right? Yeah. One steel is more
resistant to abrasion than the other.
Bingo. So, and I'm talking to him about that. I'm like, no fucking way. Like, get out of town. Right? Because I'm like...
With sandpaper, you can't get that effect because sandpaper is going to take off an equal amount of layers. You can't get that differentiation in layers with sandpaper. Mm. But with a sandblaster, it's going to get into those grooves.
Yep. Right. So I was talking to him about that, right? Because now it's like the question pops into my mind, like, okay, now I have to ask, what's the deal with these soft patterns versus, you know, our hard patterns? You're not using acid, right? And he's like, well, now there might be something lost in translation. I don't know what medium they have loaded, if they have loaded. What I've been told was that they were blasting at a certain PSI. I don't know what medium they have loaded, so I'm not going to speculate or guess because I'd rather tell you what I know rather than do guesswork and look like a fool.
That's no fun.
But
make it up.
But yeah, when they prepare their Damascus, they're it's not all hardenable steel, hence the core.
Oh no way.
Yeah.
Which is kind of similar to what we do too. If you use if you're using nickel and stuff like that, if you're using like certain steels,
copper, brass, bigger forged steel.
Yeah. Now,
granted, they also have some really sexy steels over there, like Hitachi Blue Super and all that, which if I had that, I'd be putting it in a core too,
on the cutting edge, you're good, right?
Yeah, exactly. You just need that core to be your cutting edge and you're laughing.
Yep.
And,
makes sense.
Yeah, it was a really fun thing to learn. Totally unexpected find, but you know, like, hey, my lesson, pass it on if it
would be a different look. I would suspect that you could probably pull out a Hamon like that as well. You wouldn't get all the activity that you would get. Like, you wouldn't see the ashy lines and things like that, I would suspect. But if you did a Hamon, there is a transition between hardened steel and soft steel. So I would imagine that if you use that technique, you would see the transition. You would see a Hamon.
That'd be interesting. It would probably be an interesting experiment.
Probably be very, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like cloudy. Like it would.
That's what I was thinking.
Fuzzy Hamon. Like if you try to get a Hamon out of 5160.
Fuzzy Wuzzy was a bear. Fuzzy Wuzzy had no hair.
Yeah. Exactly. That's the song I had in mind.
I've learned my lesson. When I'm doing Hamons now, I'm going to probably be sticking to stones But that was an interesting one. He took us on a tour of his shop and, you know, showed us all the tools, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know what? It's okay for a shop to be a bit messy. So maybe I'll clean up my shop half as much so it's like on par here.
The smallest shop I've ever seen was my friend who I haven't spoken to in a decade, Stefano Trentini. He's a knife maker, makes amazing knives out of Italy, in Venice, Italy. And his knife shop is under a bridge. And it literally has pictures of himself on the internet with his arms stretched out and he's touching both sides of the wall. Wow. And then he can stretch his arms out and touch the door and the back. And he makes these knives that you would think, you know, like they're on par with guys like Niels and that, like Niels Vandenberg. I say his last name. Yes.
And, yeah.
Wow. Well,
you don't need a big shop to do big things.
On par, man. And then
that's what I try to tell all the girls, man.
It's not the size of the tool. Right? I mean, sorry.
Oh, boy.
The size of the shop.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Come on, Rick. Yeah, after that, we left Sakai. And, well, we tried to leave Sakai. That was actually hard because there's a typhoon rolling through.
Oh, shoot.
And it just, as we finished our day, it was coming in and the water levels were rising and these subways that needed to cross the river were like, yeah, we're not doing that anymore. So
the subways became submarines.
We had to find a subway line that was high enough to still be running. So yeah, we made it to Sakai. We met up with Mayuko's brother, and yeah, that was a fun good time.
That's good.
Yeah, then after Osaka, you know, we Osaka was a fun place. You know, we had to hit Nara. Nara is the city that's famous for the deer.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The deer. Yeah. You bow to the deer. The deer bow back.
They're
living in the city in harmony with people. They obey traffic stops. They kind of know where they're okay to go in the city, and everyone treats them with like the utmost respect.
Weird.
I've seen pictures of them standing when it's raining outside. They're standing in shelters with the people right next to them and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really very cool. Very friendly. I was having a great old time.
That's cool.
Like, yeah. Then you know, we head back to Tokyo because her parents' place is in Yokohama, and they were nice enough to let us, you know, stay with them for the entire time that we were in the area. Her parents were like super welcoming. I'll be the first to admit I was kind of nervous to meet her folks. Right. But no, they're both her mother, her father, wonderful people. Wonderful, wonderful people.
That's great.
Actually, yeah, I brought one of my knives over there and I gave it to them. So
that's super great, awesome, buddy. Yeah. F5.
So, yeah, so they threw a sushi party and they got a video up there of her cutting the tuna with the knife. So
is that on your Instagram, dude?
It is.
Oh, that's promo video right there. That's like, yeah, that should be your opener on your website.
Yeah.
My Japanese parents one day.
We went to Hakone, which is a small town, village, I would say, by a volcano.
Oh, no, yeah.
And it's famous for its hot springs, which are actually pumped from the volcano.
Yes.
Right? Really nice. So Mayu and her mom, so saunas are there's the male area, there's the female area. So I went in with her father, she went in with her mother. Of course they took a lot longer than we did. So I'm back in the room and her father's, you know, he is really nice guy. He is pulling out as much English as he can to communicate with me because my Japanese is not on a conversational level, but we kept the conversation rolling and it was really nice. It was really nice of him to just, because I used to teach English, right? I taught English for like 10 and a half, 11 years. I know just how hard it is when you're out of practice to really throw yourself into the frying pan and possibly, you know, embarrass yourself or make a mistake. Because when you're speaking another language, making a mistake is like, that's the nerve-wracking experience, right?
Well, he was probably trying to look up stuff too. Like, how do you say you're not enough not for all. My daughter? No, so he's trying to tell you he only knew a few words like you should leave. Stay away from my daughter.
Canadian insults, take off hoser.
Yeah.
You jerks. No, it was very nice. Very.
Wait, here's another one. You suck at hockey.
There you go.
Oh, that wouldn't faze me at all. I'm not a hockey fan.
I know, buddy, but it's Canadian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm immune to that one.
Into a dumpster.
Good old dumpster fire.
Here we go again.
Dumpster. Wasn't that the key word or the word of the day?
Back in the day, dumpster. It sure was.
Dumpster fire.
That's it. But yeah, it's kind of sums up my Japan trip, you know, and that
so fired, jealous.
That fired me up. Because as soon as I got home, I hit the workshop making knives for the Great Lakes Knife Show.
Oh, yeah.
That was my very first knife show.
When was that?
So that was in August, this last August.
Right. They have that. They're going to do that again in August probably, right?
I really hope so. I had an amazing time. That was my very first knife show. I never really felt confident enough to put my work on the line in front of my peers like that. Yeah. And I kind of decided this time, take it as a challenge, good or bad or anywhere in between, just put myself out there.
And good.
Well, I met a lot of makers in person that I've really wanted to meet. And even before that, leading up to the show, there was Can Iron,
which I
attended initially to help Brad out,
and you end up freaking being a
geez.
Brad dude,
yeah. Poor Brad. I mean,
oh man, dude, there's so much more we want to talk about. I forgot about that.
Yeah, oh,
yeah.
Shit.
That's another episode, man.
It's another one, I guess. Yeah, like it's
because that was huge for you.
That was huge for me. I was not expecting to be put into that. I'm not going to say put into that. I was not expected to be asked to do that. But then at the moment, it was like, well, I'm not going to let my bro just like tank and have to drop out. No, so, of course. I'm going to help him out.
So just for the people that don't know, Brad Millman was a presenter and he was doing a bang up job, no pun intended. But he got a case of heat stroke or heat exhaustion or something, and he couldn't finish. And he asked Steve to step up, and Steve out of nowhere
came forth
and really, really, really knocked it out of the park. It's good.
It was a 2-day thing. The first day was, I was doing a PowerPoint presentation in the auditorium there, and that I can do because I can just revert back to teacher days and be like, okay. So we have, I've got an hour. I can probably bullshit 2 hours out of this, you know, the old English class days. But you know, as I'm doing that, I'm looking into the crowd and I'm like, oh my god, fuck, is that Douglas Morlock sitting in the crowd? And I'm like, shit, one of my other like blacksmith heroes is here watching me. I'm like, god damn, why did you have to come? But no, it was really nice to just see the turnout and really good supportive folks. And then the next day I came in and Brad is like, I need you to do that demo. I'm out. So pulled up my big boy pants and it's you know, when you're at home in your home forge, your home shop, you have the home field advantage. When you're I think Seinfeld did an episode on that. When you're when you're forging with someone else's forge, someone else's anvil, and just all the equipment is new, you're trying to figure out how to regulate the temperature on the forge, you know, it's like,
yeah, but that's what people need to know. You know, like when everything goes perfectly well, you don't learn a whole, I mean, well, you learn a lot, but to watch somebody get past these hurdles and to, when something goes off track and to see somebody in real time, bring it back in, that's where the big stuff happens, man. Like those are the things, because anybody can watch somebody make a knife on YouTube, but they can't see
actual like failure through a knife build or something, or
exactly
some other demonstration, and then the demonstrator taking the time after the failure to explain what the failure was, why it happened, how to avoid that in future cases and whatnot.
Because that's real life, man.
Yeah
that's the way it is.
That's what we all learn from, is our failures.
Is exactly right. I've always said, you know, failure is, first off, you know, failures are the best educator, because you learn from it. You don't want to do it again. But second of all, it's technically not really a failure if you learn something from it.
Yeah.
If you keep doing it and you don't learn something from it, then yes, I guess it is. But, you know,
if you don't fail, you're not learning. And
that's it.
And I know that whenever I've gotten stagnant in what I do, I push myself to do something that I know I can't do right out of the gate, just so that I can go through that learning, because that learning curve is vital, because it helps you with other things as well, you know.
Ever notice something about when you do something that's outside of your norm, like you learn something, like say for example, you've never skated on ice skates before, and somebody teaches you how to skate on ice skates, and you walk away that day, you now know how to skate on ice, you know that feeling, you understand the physics of it, your brain changes. Like you literally can feel your brain change. It's fucked up.
Yeah. Man. Oh, for sure. For sure.
Yes.
And I'll just make a plug, because Rick ain't gonna do it. But if you want to feel that really good brain change, you should check out Rick's website. Look at his classes, because that guy will give you a lot of brain change. For I'll better or for brain. Worse, I don't know, but go for it. No,
on that note, you guys, I have to get going. It's my kid's last swimming lesson of her segment here. I got to make sure I'm there for it. I appreciate both of you so much for sitting down and giving us the time for this episode of Fort Side Chat, dude. Rick, having you on as a co-host, amazing. Steve, having you back again, also amazing. How about the two of you take us and shut it down with a good old coo-coo-coo? Steve?
We could.
Do you want to lead it, Rick, or shall I?
Do we do the whole thing? Like, I don't know if I can hit all the notes, but we'll try.
You do it. You can do it.
Ready? Let's do it on three. One, two.
But you go first. She's like, I just flipped me off on two.
You're number one.
I'm number one.
One, two, three.
There you go. Okay.
Start us off.
Good day.
Good day, guys.
To run, go see my kid, pass her last swimming lesson of the session. She did great. It was nice that I got to be able to run out and go see that. So thank you very much for giving me the chance to run out like that and not being
right on
pissy with
it's
me.
Good. I'm glad it went swimmingly.
It went swimmingly, yes. Thank you. Now I don't have any worries when we come out to visit you that we can go swimming in the ocean.
There you go.
Yeah.
Keep the shark tracker on, though.
Steve, is there sharks where you are, dude?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
A lot more than there used to be.
Crazy.
Just because of the weather pattern shifting, the water temperatures are shifting. So now, just off the coast, we have a shark nursery. So basically, what? Where all the baby sharks hang out.
Crazy, wow, dude.
We've had not too far from here, maybe about 20 minutes, they had the largest great white ever recorded. It came through.
Well, wasn't the concept of Jaws near your area somewhere?
It was Maine, so yeah. Kind of my area. I'm on the opposite side of the province from the Bay of Fundy side, though.
That's okay.
Where Maine is. But yeah, we're on the opposite side. But there's a website that's a tracker. In fact, one of my friends goes out with the boats that tag all the sharks. So they basically have this big platform that lowers down the side of the boat, and it goes into the water. And then they come up next to the sharks and they coax them in, and then they lift it, and the sharks are basically out of the water at that point. And then they jump down and tag them and drop it back down, and the sharks take off.
Crazy.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's got to be an interesting job, hey?
But I was playing a gig on a barge. I was playing music on a barge. We had this big party out, one of the things, and somebody said, "Oh, I think his name was Hilton. Hilton, the 16-foot great white male, is in the bay with us right now." They're like,
"Man, 16-foot." My mind just painted all sorts of different pictures off of what you were just describing to us. It's been playing music on a barge, dude. Like, I forgot, you used to be a drummer, right? Well, like, used to be a drummer. You still drum, but you were, like, in a band back in the day, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in a bunch of bands, man. I was, like, a serious gigging musician.
Yeah, dude.
It's also featured, and he has some music videos.
Yeah, man, I was on Much Music for a little while.
What?
Yeah, no. We had four videos in circulation. We did a little tour in Europe, shot some videos in Europe in the mountains.
Rad.
We were kind of rock stars for a little while. It was really cool, man. We had paparazzi and
what the hell? This is like a completely different world than you live in now, dude.
Yeah, music's always been in the background.
Yeah,
I've been playing since grade 10 or so, but yeah,
you still play a lot right now.
Yeah, I got my drums are set up in the shop. I don't know if you can
see. No, that's awesome, dude. Right,
it's kind of behind the counter there, but it's in the corner.
Oh, sorry.
Do you play music, Steve?
Oh, no, I mean,
not musically.
I mean, in high school, I was. You know, in music class, I did the saxophone, but
I got a trumpet up there that I haven't touched in years. The
the hairy banjo. The bagpipe.
The bagpipe. Poor guy. Poor Steve. Speaking of music, you guys, that's one of the things that we never brought up on last, on the episode, is what we've been listening to in the shop lately. Steve and I ended up trying to sit down last night after I got back from swimming lessons. Was that what it was, Steve?
Yeah, yeah.
You
got back from swimming lessons, then we started chatting, and then your cousin arrived.
Yeah, we got like maybe 10 minutes of conversation, and all of a sudden my cousin's knocking at the door. Hey, you gonna do that welding for me? Oh, fuck. I forgot you were coming. Shit. All right.
We just talked about like concerts that we've been to and shit.
Yeah, that's right, dude. That's right. Some good concerts. And then we got into, yeah,
some
okay.
good and some bad.
So, Rick, what have you been listening to, dude?
I listen to a lot of jazz.
Yeah.
But I listen to like the newer modern jazz, progressive stuff.
Okay. Kind of,
I kind of describe it as musician's music. Because it's not something that a lot of people would like to listen to unless you're a musician. But it's cool to see live and stuff like that. But it's not
something a lot of people. I'm intrigued. I'm very intrigued, dude. Drop some names.
And well, drop them.
Brad Meldow and Mark Juliana. They actually have a band together that they made called Meliana. and it's kind of cool. It's kind of like a meld of hip hop, jazz, and like fusion rock stuff. It's basically jazz with almost a backbeat to it, and it's really cool.
You have got me very intrigued as to checking that out, man, because that sounds... Do you know who King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard are?
Yes. I'm not super familiar with it, but I know who they are, yeah.
Yeah, so they've got a very jazzy feel in a lot of their music, but rock and roll and electronics mixed into it, dude. So
have you ever heard of Snarky Puppy?
No.
Okay, that's another one, man. You got to listen to those dudes.
Check that out for sure.
That's some more kind of jazz, progressive jazz type of stuff.
Nice. I was telling Steve, I recently got turned onto a band through KEXP on YouTube, Frankie and the Witch Fingers. Oh, ooh, man.
I haven't heard that. I'm going to have to write that down.
So good. So fucking good. The energy in there. And I'm not huge on music. What's the word I'm looking for? Intricacies. But I have a very strong feeling from listening to these guys that they are very intricate with their equipment and the tunes that they're putting out compared to a lot of other bands just putting out, you know, the same riff throughout the entire song or whatever. These guys are all over the place and then bringing it back again. It's just awesome, dude.
That's right. Great. Awesome.
Yeah. Steve, what were you saying you were listening to again, man?
Steel Panther.
Right. Yes.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
You know, I love that, you know, even though they were like, what, formed in like the 2000s, right? I just love how they just went with that 80s hair metal vibe and just kind of just, hey guys, let's make a hair band.
Yeah,
it's like the way they interact with the crowd, man. Have you seen the ones where like they bring kids up and stuff? And
I've always wanted to. I've ever since like I started listening to them, which is actually, I'd say fairly recently. I just kind of stumbled upon them in the, geez, must have been like, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. Ever since I started listening to them, I've been listening more and more, and I just like, man, I'd love to see these guys live. Yeah. And so then I found out they were recently in Toronto, and I'm like, ah, shit.
You've never seen the videos? Have you ever seen their videos?
No.
Oh, boy. Look up their videos on YouTube, man.
Yeah, bud.
Okay.
These guys, they swear all the time, right? They're like rockers. They play the part. They look the part. They look like Motley Crue up there. Or,
totally. Yeah. I've seen their pictures. I love it.
I was jerking off to them for 10 years until my mom told me they were guys.
You're still jerking off, though. but they had a kid in the crowd, and they're like, what's that fucking kid doing here, or whatever, you know? Like, I can't believe your parents brought you to this fucking concert. And they're like just swearing up a storm, right? And then the kid says he can play guitar, and he's like, get up here. And he brings him up on stage, and the kid starts playing guitar. I think it was partially set up.
But
the kid plays guitar, and, you know, the lead singer's like, holy cow, man, we're going to replace our guy with him. And they played a tune with the kid.
And awesome.
It was awesome, man. Like, they are really good guys, too. Like, they do lots of charity work and stuff, so they're awesome.
Nice.
That sounds good, yep. You're making me think of a comedian I've seen where he's doing a big comedy act, and there's the people in the front row, and there's a dad and a mom, and they've got their little kid with them, probably 14. I think he was 14. And the comedian starts bugging him, you know, like, what do you got a 14-year-old kid to a comedy show, like an adult comedy show? Like, he's gonna be hearing things, I'm sorry to say. Like, for example, do you know what it's you don't know much about eating pussy, do you? It's kind of like eating Caesar salad. The first time you eat it, you're like, oh, that's a little tangy, but then you want more Caesar salad, more Caesar salad. All of a sudden, next thing you know, you can't get enough Caesar salad. Poor 14-year-old kid, hey? What have you been working on in your shop, Steve? I don't think we hit that at all. Like, what's on your hit list right now? You got any knives on the current whip or?
Yeah, so right now, I have 4 knives, somewhere in the, I guess most of them are in the large to medium petty knife range.
Damascus?
Most of them, yes. One of them's mono, that ADC RV2.
And this is Damascus you make yourself as well, right?
Oh, yes. All my Damascus is done in-house, with the exception. So, okay, so just the hit list on these 4. So I've got 1 mono steel from ADC RV2. I've got 2 Damascus that are totally made in-house. And then I've got 1 Damascus that's not made by me. Actually, Kevin from KC Forge came by, and he gave me a piece of canister Damascus. And he's like, hey, I want you to make something with this. Nice. So it was sitting around my shop for a while. And cause like, I'm thinking about like, well, what am I going to do with that? I got to think of something, you know, like something choice. And then the knife show came around and I was really focusing on that. And I finished all my knives and I'm like, well, you know what? Maybe I can squeeze out another one in time for the show. So I did another batch of knives. They never made it to the show. Because you know, I'd rather go at a pace that I can guarantee quality rather than rush it and you know get one of those god awful emails down the line because I rushed things. So I've got a bunch of knives on the ready. They're all polished and one of them was. It must have been something on my thumb or something, and there's a little bit of corrosion in a thumbprint pattern, so I have to rehand sand that and then rebuff that. But you know, buffing is just got a whole lot easier since I picked up those wheels from Lawrence.
Nice.
Those
I gotta check those out.
Combat Abrasives airway wheels. Like if you do it right and you do it safely, those will change your game. But
really?
You got to do them safely because those things can, like,
well, even regular really buffing
wheels. Well, yeah, buffing in general. If you're not careful, you could really wind up seriously hurt.
Yeah,
I've always
those are somewhat loose, right? Like those aren't they're not a tightly woven buffing.
Yeah, thing. When you get them, they're tight, but you have to use the rake to break up the flaps and everything. Yeah.
Interesting.
So before you start applying compound. But still, so
it comes
they're
with
stiff
a little...
enough that if they catch the blade, they will throw it in like hard.
So yep. Does it come with a rake that you use for that then?
I've
never
buy
dealt
the
with
rake
that. Okay.
But it's not like the rake is not expensive and it's a big rake, so you can really hold on to it. And get in there.
And you've got to use that rake over and over again on the wheel as it ages. Or?
Yeah, just because the buffing compound kind of glazes over.
Totally.
Yeah.
And you got to break it up to get to the good stuff. So the rake is just like, I'm not sure what Lawrence's rakes look like. Does he sell the rakes too?
Oh, he does. They're about yay long. I'd say about maybe a foot.
They're kind of like this. But with a tooth thing on there?
Yeah, that's right. I'd say a bit longer than that, actually.
You guys,
maybe a foot and a half.
People can't see these things. You can't see like this.
Well, you can just go on his website and type in rake, and I'm sure it'll pop up. MaritimeKnifeSupply.com.
To give it a visual, think of like a paint stir stick with a steel upside down tooth thing that you hang onto the paint stick so that it doesn't rip out of your hands, and you just basically put this toothy thing on the buffing wheel and it rips all the stuff off the surface.
Yeah.
And is that something that you would normally use like on all buffing wheels or is that specific to that style of buffing wheel?
You should use one on all buffing wheels because you could gather anything, you know, something flies you know, you get a bit of abrasive. If it's close to your grinder or something, you get abrasive on there, then that's going to, you know, you want to clear it.
This is not something I knew a whole lot about. This is awesome, you guys. I knew nothing about this. What the fuck?
I don't do a lot of buffing, so I'm not an expert on the buffing part of it, but I have.
Also really useful for like clearing off like excess compound on a buffing wheel.
Right, yeah. Totally. Yeah.
I could see I've also heard people taking like old 36 grit or 60 grit belts and using that, but that was on a Reddit dive, so I can't attest to that or anything.
It doesn't dig in well enough, I don't think.
Yeah.
And I would be worried about what Rick brought up earlier with some of it possibly getting embedded in the wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Grit. Like if you get, like I also use, I use paper wheel when I sharpen sometimes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The paper wheel, every time I use it, I give it a quick cleaning. Because yeah. I have covers that go over them, but you don't know what gets in there. And it could even be like the burr from a knife you're sharpening on it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You sharpen
the burr off and the burr gets caught on the wheel. So then the next time you go by, when you look at it, when you look at it with like a jeweler's loop or something, you see these scratches that are perfectly timed. It's because there's a piece of something on the wheel and it just keeps passing by and scraping.
Yeah,
totally.
See, I've always been very careful with my paper wheel. I feel like humidity would be a big factor in me having to buy another $100 paper wheel. So I've always, anytime I get something from like Scamazon or something, I always, you know, those little silicone packs.
Yeah.
I always keep those. Yep. And I have a Princess Auto plastic bag and I have a whole bunch of them inside and I just cover the wheel with it and turn the wheel until it kind of wraps itself tight. And I kind of use that as a protective case for
it. I use those silicone packs. I always keep those. I keep them in all the drawers. I keep them in my leather cabinet and every drawer.
Oh, they're great. They're awesome.
Something about those packs that I know of well about how they can absorb moisture, but once they absorb that moisture, they have absorbed that moisture now and will actually carry that moisture into whatever you put them into if they've absorbed that moisture already. So if you are in an area where moisture is an issue and you're storing them in open air, they will have absorbed that moisture and will be at that level of moisture. So what you can do is throw it in the oven at a very low heat and it'll help bake that moisture out of it. And then when you're done, take it out and put it in an airtight container if you've got one that you can store it in. And yep. it'll help.
I switch mine out every once in a while and pretty much do exactly what you said. I either put it outside in the sun on my car hood or something, lay them out.
Yeah.
And you can see them shrink. Like they shrink.
I've always replaced them out, but I never even thought to renew them. I just get them in. Like I but just going back, those paper wheels are like those are top shelf.
I like them. I would only recommend the slotted one, though.
Yeah.
What about a leather wheel? How do they compare to a leather wheel? Like, is the paper wheel meant for stropping, essentially?
Paper wheel is the slotted paper wheel with the you put your own compound on it. And you can put diamond compound or you can put rouge, whatever you want to put on it.
Okay.
The difference with the slotted wheel is that those slots, they blow air. Oh
yeah.
So when you turn the wheel on, you put your hand there, it's like cold air being pushed on your hand.
Yeah.
And it cools the blade while it goes.
The other wheels come with it,
like the ones with abrasive on them and stuff, they don't have the slots and it's really easy to build up heat. Doing that. So you got to be careful with that. But I mean, it's all about the touch too, right? Like you have to just really have a light touch. But that paper wheel though, man, it's awesome. Really,
what stage of sharpening are you going to go to the paper wheel? Is that your final stage or
final?
So a kind of the idea of like, I know the leather strop is like high on the list for people when they want to get that ultimate sharp edge. And that's why I ask, like, how is it comparing to the leather stropping? And I know you can get like a leather wheel too, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't beat it. I've tried leather and then I look at it under a little microscope thing, and that paper wheel gives a flawless.
This is awesome.
Well, not flawless, but less close. Flawed. Finish. Now, I know a lot of people get worried about the, you can induce heat if you push too hard. So you can really screw it up, but you can do that with just about anything. Hand stone. Even using a hand stone, if you don't use oil or water on it. Like, I've burnt my finger on just sharpening like a chisel for my construction belt or whatever, like nothing. I've gone on a stone or I have a granite block with some sandpaper on it. I've done that and I've burnt my finger on the blade just going by hand. Yep. So
does not doubt me.
You're definitely building heat up there, but if you're very like it, I just let it sit on the top, and you got to get the right angle. It really did take me about 2 or 3 months before I was able to be consistent with the paper wheel.
Mm.
Because especially if you're using stones or plates to put in your edge, so those will be a flat plane, right? Or slightly convex if you're actually, because we're human. So it'll be, but mostly flat. And then you go to the wheel, and now the wheel has a radius to it. So you have to have the angle right, or you either won't polish the edge, or you will have it too tilted and it'll actually dull the edge. So you got to find the happy place in there. And another thing I recommend for wheels is to run them backwards. Run them away from you.
Oh.
As opposed to regular grinders go this way. Like, all I did is I took my grinder, the bench grinder. I had this bench grinder. And I took it off its base and turned it around on the base and put it back down. So the controls are still in the front. But it runs away from me. And I have all these arrows making sure
that everybody knows it. I did the same thing. I do not want arrows. Oh, yeah, I would totally forget if I didn't have the arrows.
Then that way you can see the burr as you do it, and it's like right in front of you, and it's going away, so you're not getting shit blown back in your face.
Mm.
And you can actually see the burr. You can tilt the knife until you see the burr appear, and then you know you're right on the edge, and then you follow it along, and you see the burr raise, and then you flip it around, you go the other way, and then eventually you see the bird just fly off of it.
Yeah. I've done sharpening quite a few ways, and currently the paper wheel, I've gotten some of the most sharp outcomes from that.
And this is awesome. Paper wheel, but you can take your finger and put it lightly on the paper wheel, and it doesn't burn you. It doesn't do anything because the air is cooling it. So, and I put the blade down with the same amount of pressure I would put my finger down. So if I can't feel it on my skin building up the heat, it's most likely, as far as I can tell, not building up at the edge.
Yeah. I've never had an overheat on the paper wheel, the slotted paper wheel.
No, me neither.
You know what sucks, man, is when you have, I don't know if you guys have any nerve damage at all, but I've got nerve damage in my fingertips. I get numbness. And because of that, sometimes I don't feel when things are getting too hot. And inadvertently, I'll end up with blisters like deep under my skin. I'll be like, what the fuck? My skin's all tough. Oh, I must have been holding onto something too hot and I got a blister under my skin there. That makes it really difficult when it comes to being able to sharpen things, because you rely on that feel for that heat a lot, right?
Yes, especially when you're bringing your main bevels down, like in when you're bringing those big flats down, that's when the heat can build up, when you're taking a lot of material off.
Yeah.
And after heat treat, you go to bring those flats back down or the bevels, And so, if you can't feel the heat, that could be an issue.
I guess to counteract that, you could install one of those misting spray systems on your 2x72, or you could just test it by licking it.
Yeah, well, that's what I do.
There you go.
That's essentially what I do.
Yeah. I put it on and then I hold my tongue to it.
As I'm sharpening, yeah.
Yeah. And make sure you're licking the edge. That's the important part.
That's how I test for sharpness. I test for heat and sharpness, yeah.
Yeah.
And something about the saliva gives it that extra little bit of edge too, right?
Yeah.
Helps cool as you're grinding.
So, speaking of saliva.
Oh God.
Here we go.
Wait, Darcy, you're going to bring up Quap, aren't you?
Oh yeah, this is the Darcy special.
The dumpster fire has been lit once again.
No. So just to revert back, I totally forgot about this part of going back to when I was in the Japanese forge.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, he did the heat treats on the knives and tempering, right?
Oh.
So.
I think I know where you're going.
Yeah. So, like, you know, some folks would toss it in a tempering oven. Some folks would watch the colors run and quench. But no, this guy, he would have it in the fire, go back and forth, and he'd just lick his finger and then touch it with his finger. And he could determine, based on the sizzle on his finger, if it was ready or not. And it was really cool just watching him go about that. And
That'll get you in the ballpark for sure.
Yeah.
It's hard to have consistency that way, but
I suppose when you're doing it for that long, you kind of get consistent. But I mean, obviously I use a tempering oven for, like, I use my kiln for that, but
you can't tell a 15 degree difference with your licked finger.
Yeah. It does have limitations.
Means a lot when you're tempering.
Yeah, exactly what I was thinking too, man. And if you look into Dr. Laren Thomas's book, that he explains big time, man. That heat curve index. Spencer Sanderson got that made into a poster. If anybody wants to get that poster, you can hit up Spencer.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. I thought about getting one.
That's really cool.
Poster to have in the shop. I've got the I've got the heat index chart for colors versus temperature. It totally is, but it gives you an idea. The reason I've got that is on one side of the chart, it gives you your colors. In the middle of the chart, it gives you your temperature ranges. And then on the other side of the chart, it gives you what items should fall into those temper ranges. And I leaned heavily on it just recently because on that, it shows that springs are way up there in temper range. And that's one of the things I had a huge battle with that just like a week ago, you guys. I made 5 springs and each one of them ended up failing on me. Talking to Mark Krause about it after the fact, and he was explaining to me that when you're tempering a spring, you literally need to bring it past temper colors. You want to go into gray.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You should be up around 700 degrees or so, I think. And that's past the peacock blue getting into gray.
Yep.
It's basically tempered martensite. It's
yes.
Tempered out. That's what you want, because that's when the structure of martensite itself gives the strength. Not necessarily the hard. Well, that's kind of a bad way to say it. It's not necessarily the hardness. It's the, like, tempered martensite. Like, if you completely temper out, like, that's how crowbars are made. They basically fully harden a crowbar, and then you temper the shit out of it. And now it's a tempered martensite crowbar, which is stronger than a perlite crowbar, like a one that's
totally,
not
yeah.
hasn't been hardened, right? You know, but yet, I mean, that's how they do it, right? It's just a stronger internal structure to begin with.
I was listening to a really interesting chat that Dr. Laren Thomas had put on YouTube recently, and he was talking about bainite and the structure of bainite, and that was like, what? I'd never heard of that before. Mind blowing to hear about that stuff and how, if you can achieve that, how that is essentially your best,
range to get into if you can.
I would say you definitely need to be using salts if you're going to do that, though.
Okay.
Mar tempering, mar quenching, how it's done. You definitely need salts.
Yeah, I don't
sure
know.
Sure, would like to get my hands on a salt kiln, though. Wouldn't that be fun?
To get bainite, and I'm not going to be very accurate. I'm not going to be like Laren. I'm probably going to miss stuff. I don't actually do bainite, but I have an idea. I know how it's done. So okay. You get, let's just say 1500 degrees. Your blade's at 1500 degrees, and you pull it out of your hot salts or your kiln. You can use a kiln too, an oven, and you put it into your low temperature salts that are sitting at about 450 or 400. You put that in there. Hold on one second.
Sure. It's all good, bud.
Key for what? I don't have a key. What's that? All right.
I have the key to your heart. That's what you're supposed to say.
My car. That's my daughter. It's the key to the car.
Oh, she is. And she also probably carries the key to your heart too, right?
Yeah, she's got it on there somewhere.
So anyways, bainite, 1500 into the low temperature salts.
Into the low temperature salts. And it needs to be salts because it's got to take that. It's got to quench the blade too, right? So it's got to take it from 1500 down to 450 as fast as oil would. And you can only do that with salts, right? Or I shouldn't say you can only do that with salts, but that's as far as I know, that's
interesting.
The best way to do it is with salts. And so you hold it at that temperature. And do you know what? Do you know why you would hold it at that temperature, Steve? We've talked
about this.
So when you harden something, you quench it at 1500, it drops below 900 or so, and that sets it on the path to harden. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't actually harden until it gets down below 500 degrees.
Right.
So it's still flexible. Like I've done a demo where I've quenched a blade, bring it out, bend it, put a 90 degree bend in it, wait a couple seconds, put it back, and then it hardens.
No.
Yeah. So what you wanted, so between, let's just say 500 and 120 Fahrenheit. That's the range that martensite actually forms. So that's the temperature range that the steel actually hardens, like physically changes its
structure. This falls into, you see so many people harden their blades and they pull it out and it's still smoking hot and it's like, no, get it back in there.
Yeah. That's okay. I mean, if you pull it out and it's smoking, but it still looks like it's wet, you're okay.
Okay.
If you pull it out and it goes dry or it just bursts in the flames and then is dead
dry. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's not good.
She done.
Good. Good.
So the longer you can keep it in that temperature range of, 500 or 450 or and between one, that and 120, the longer you can keep it in there, the more it'll transform. So, but if you keep it just above that, like the 500 range, so it hasn't quite gone to martensite yet. It's still kind of in the boundary. And you hold it there, then it'll form bainite. Instead of martensite. And that's the stuff, man. It's pretty good. I don't think it really does much for knives, but for swords, in that you get a super tough sword and it still holds an edge really well. And that's about all I know about bainite.
Yeah, I know Laren was explaining that will give you the ultimate edge retention is if you have bainite on your edge. I'm pretty, man. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this because I don't remember 100%, but I'm pretty sure that's what he was saying.
I'm not sure if it was ultimate edge retention, but it's a really good balance of toughness and strength.
That's what it was. That's what it was. It gives you, it's your best balance point between edge retention and strength.
Yeah, because as bladesmiths, we juggle between strength and toughness. You know, strength, the ability to resist deformation. Toughness is the ability to deform without catastrophic failure.
Yep.
We're always juggling that. And that Bayonite seems to have that nice little thing, but it's not the be all end all, or else everybody would be doing Bayonite, right? They would be doing it in production and stuff too, right? So it's a bit of a, I don't know if you'd call it obscure, but
it's not
like a super secret, if that's, you know, it's not a secret
thing. But maybe it's not like a hack. Maybe it's not cost effective, and that's more why people lean away from doing it, is because it's just it for the benefit of doing it isn't worth the cost of doing it either, right?
Yeah. You'd have to think of that. I mean, I'm sure. Well, Laren obviously has much more to say on it. That's, you know, I'm just parroting stuff I've probably heard him say, and then I know that there are a couple of sword makers that use that formula as well.
Hmm. Oh, very, very interesting, man. Very, very interesting to learn about that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not a huge proponent of the knife game type thing. We all know this. I'm not a knife maker, but I get, like, Nick likes to call me a knife maker because I've made and sold a knife. Big deal. I'm not a knife maker like you guys, man. I don't know all this stuff, man. Like, you're blowing my mind when it comes to explaining the science behind this stuff, Rick. It really is amazing to learn all this stuff.
And I don't explain the science like at a, you know, a metallurgist level. I'm not a metallurgist at all. But I kind of get it, and I try to use analogies that help you. I'm mostly right. So a friend of mine, Kevin Cashin, is like he was like a guru on heat treat and stuff, and he's very knowledgeable. And when I started teaching, I was worried that about teaching this stuff, because I'm not a metallurgist and that, and I could have bad habits. I'm sure I do have bad habits. He said no. He said, Your analogies are great. He's like, you're like the gateway drug to real metallurgy.
And in my honest opinion, I think that's what every knife maker should aspire to, is that level of, at least that level of knowledge. Because
basic knowledge, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's also really important to understand like what you're doing to the steel and what's happening with the steel, especially if it's
Steve will remember when I don't give I don't teach recipes on how to heat treat. I kind of teach the very basics of metallurgy and allow you to make your own recipes depending on the types of steel you use. So, and that way, I mean, you could get a recipe and do it exactly the way it's done. And then if something happens to troubleshoot it, if you don't know everything that's supposed to happen, you're going to have a hard time troubleshooting that thing. Yeah. Where if you have a basic metallurgical understanding, you can say, okay, well, this is happening, so most likely it's because of this. And then you can actually troubleshoot your own, you know, your own thing.
And you have pinpointed 100% why I haven't dove into making knives. I've had a lot of people tell me that, well, you're not going to learn these things until you start making knives. And I somewhat disagree. I believe there's a level of knowledge you should aspire to attain before you jump into making certain items. Yes. And I think knives are one of those things that it helps you exponentially to gain some of this metallurgical knowledge before you dive in to start making the knives and get stuck looking at it going like, why did this happen?
Yeah.
Read a fucking book. You'll know in 2 seconds why that happened. Don't waste your time making a bunch of failures, right?
Well,
right. Well,
and I mentioned earlier that one of the like brain changing experience when I took Rick's class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this, what we're just talking about, was one of those like just I walked away from, not let alone the class, I walked away from that lesson feeling changed. Yeah. Just having a high, walking away from the table, having a higher understanding of, you know, what we're doing, it's incredibly beneficial. And I knew that I was going to learn stuff going into Rick's class, but I didn't know the extent of just the understanding I would take from it.
Well, that's awesome, man. Thanks for saying that.
For sure.
But yeah, it's
getting taught how to do reach rounds is great.
It is. It is.
Unfortunately, our guest expert Darcy couldn't show up for that.
He'd tell you how to do it in the cornfield with your cousin, eh? Oh boy. Okay, guys.
Oh, I'm going to hell.
Yeah, we might. We're 45 minutes in on this after show. I think it's been a pretty excellent recording. We can add this into the episode. I'm going to try to add in that little tidbit of us talking about concerts too, man, because there was some funny shit in there that we talked about. And outside of that, like, if I'm just looking at what we've got for recording time here, we had an hour and 45 in the first recording, and then Steve and I, we sat down for 12 minutes on a second recording, and now we've got another, we're at 42 right now. So this is going to be a hefty episode for people to dive through, and I appreciate if you've listened through the entire thing. Thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Forge Chat. Ya hosers, take off, eh?
Take off, eh?
And have a good day.
Okay, good day, guys.
Good day.